Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Soho Radio Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And we have got quite a sexy show coming up for you, because joining me today is Hannah Wilson, a clinical researcher with the Sex Hormones Group at Charing Cross Hospital. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Matilda.
And how are you?
I'm very well this morning. How are you?
Fantastic. So we'll be hearing all about your research with cancer and sex hormones later in the show. Now, a hormone is a chemical messenger in our body. So one part of our body will release a hormone and it will affect another part of our body and tell us what to do. But Hannah, can you just tell us a little bit more before we get going about what a sex hormone is?
So yeah, sure. A sex hormone, it's the same concept as a normal hormone, as in it's released and it goes to a different part of the body. But the sex hormones, as we think of them, are involved in developing our secondary sexual characteristics. So they have lots of other functions, but primarily they sort of help us determine if we're male or female. And that's really what we're going to be focusing on this morning.
Awesome. And what are their names, the male and female hormones?
So you may have heard of them, but they are estrogen and testosterone. And testosterone is predominantly the male hormone and estrogen predominantly the female hormone. But interestingly, we actually both sexes produce both hormones. And it's about the balance of the proportions we have that give us our sexual phenotypes.
Ah, so we just have more estrogen and boys have more testosterone.
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we'll be hearing more about that later in the show. Coming up, we've also got the future of the NHS. Oh, can't get sexier than that. And some sexy smells, also known as pheromones. And for our experiment of the week, I thought long and hard about this one. I was like, hormones, chemical messengers, I know. Let's write a secret message in invisible ink.
Awesome.
So all you need if you want to take part in this experiment is some milk, some paper, and access to an iron. If you're a small child, please get an adult to help you. It takes a little bit of time, so we're actually going to set it off right now at the beginning, and I'm going to get Hannah to write me a little message in milk during the next song, and then at the end of the show we'll see if I can read it. So if you are playing along at home, get yourself some milk and start writing with your finger. Just write your message or a word on a piece of paper. But I think it's time for our first song. So, Hannah, you've chosen all the music today. And what are we starting with?
So we're going to start with a bit of Kygo and sexual healing, since we're going to be talking about sex hormones healing us. So I thought it would be a good intro to the show.
When I get that feeling, I want that sexual healing, sexual
that part of the show where we talk about the science news. Now, one of the biggest stories this week, super, super exciting. They think they found a new species of extinct human in this like inaccessible cave in South Africa. And not only is it a new species, they've literally found so many bones and teeth. I think they found 1,400 bones, 140 teeth, at least 15 individual skeletons.
Whoa.
And that is like hitting the jackpot of the century if you're a paleontologist. Normally they have to make do with like a little bit of a jawbone, half a pelvis, and draw all these conclusions. But they've found these sort of complete skeletons. And what's also really exciting is the fact that all of these bones were together in this one cave suggests that maybe it was a burial site. And they haven't managed to date the skeletons yet, but it's almost like they've described it as an anatomical mosaic, so they can't quite
place
it. They think that the shoulder and the pelvis suggest that it's a bit of an ape-like species, maybe similar to one that appeared in Africa about 4 million years ago called Australopithecus.
Nice.
But they think that if you look at the foot, they said that's much more like our species, seems much more recent, so they're not sure how old it is yet. But any form of kind of human-like behaviour, like burying your dead, is really exciting to find in an ancient species.
Yeah, so they found them in a group, did they, as opposed to an individual?
Yeah, all of them in this cave. And it's really funny. So they started excavating this cave 2 years ago in 2013. And the researcher in charge of it, a man called Jeffrey Schwartz from the University of Pittsburgh, a man called Lee Berger from the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg. Yeah, he advertised for people that were good at archaeology with a lack of claustrophobia.
Amazing. So you'd have to be involved in doing that then. You have to have a background in paleontology or just a lucky find that they found them in South Africa.
Oh no, he's definitely a paleontologist. Nice. But to excavate you just need kind of archaeology skills.
Imagine coming across that.
I know. And you've been like crawling through 10 kilometres. I don't even know how they got there in the first place. Literally 10 kilometre kind of cave shafts underground. One of them is like a 12 metre vertical drop.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And the actual cave itself was called like the Dinaldi cave. So the species, they're calling it Homo naledi.
And how's that going to be related then to us in terms of where you think it will fit in?
They think it's like a link, another link between the kind of ape-like and the human-like. And they found this other species that seemed to have sort of a mixture of ape-like and human characteristics that they thought was a bit of an exception. And they were like, oh, this anatomical mosaic. But now they found two species with all these different features that seem to be mixed in. So now they're just wondering if there's a whole new way that we may have evolved that wasn't as linear as they first thought. There are some skeptics, though.
Go on, what are they saying?
The guy I mentioned before, Jeffrey Schwartz from the University of Pittsburgh, he thinks that it doesn't look like one species. He says it looks like two cranial morphs lumped together, and then he thinks it's two different species that they've just kind of pieced together. But why would they all be in one cave? Who knows?
Exciting. That's super cool.
Mysteries of paleontology.
Yeah, for sure.
Hannah, what news story caught your eye this week?
So I have to say, I was excited by the story about the transmission of Alzheimer's potentially through surgery. And I don't know if you saw that story, but it's exciting. Well, it's interesting because it sort of goes back to when a sort of quite scary article hits the papers, how people will respond. So I thought that one was quite unusual.
So Alzheimer's, if we just... Alzheimer's is dementia, right? And
yeah.
It's sort of the when your brain cells start to die off and you lose a lot of your brain functions.
Yeah.
And I thought that was just you got that with old age and if you had like a family history of it.
Yeah, so it's quite complicated in terms of the different ways it can be acquired, but it's known to be associated with age and genetics, so as you said, family history. But before, nobody had thought it could potentially be infectious. And this article is interesting because I couldn't believe it had made it into the BBC news when there was actually only sort of eight patients or eight cases reported. So it's exciting, but it's also quite scary how information can hit the media and how we think about that. So that's really why I thought it caught my eye.
And so, wait, they actually think it can be transmitted?
Well, it's tricky. It's made it into Nature, which is quite a big scientific journal. And somebody, the UCL team have suggested that maybe Alzheimer's could be transmissible by surgeries. But of course, it's such new data.
Like brain surgery.
Yeah, it's just an idea. But it's that concept of if something is an idea, should we release it to the general public? Because that can cause widespread fear. And everybody's heard of Alzheimer's and everybody's nervous of Alzheimer's. And we're probably going to be talking a bit about that later, but it was an interesting story to hit the BBC News, I thought, from such a limited data set.
Yeah, because you don't want people to suddenly stop going to surgery
because
they're scared about it.
Exactly. And I thought the press actually handled it really well, but it was it's such a topical issue, especially with what's been going on this week in the House of Commons and things with the right to die, that it was all kind of happening at once, these sort of scary concepts for the general public.
Yeah, Amna, you heard loads about the right to die, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really, really interesting. So this is the first time that MPs debated the right, like the idea of right to die, like in 20 years. So 20 years ago, it was like an overwhelming majority. I think it was like 72% of MPs said no. And now that we've debated it, I think 74% of MPs said no again. So it's a really difficult topic. And, you know, it was a really emotionally charged debate because you had, you know, groups on one side who know they're going to die within 6 months. So the bill essentially said if someone's going to die within 6 months and they have the mental capacity to decide that they want to die, and then they have to go to court and then the court has to accept that they want to die, and then after all of that then doctor can help them with an assisted suicide. But people say is just there's too much room for abuse, and you know, the Catholic,
the slippery slope argument.
Yeah, yeah, and the church came forward saying, you know, we're just promoting suicide if we let this bill through, and even like the BMJ's, the British Medical Journal, and like doctors involved in that were like quite against the bill, because there was the concept itself I think should be discussed, but I think the bill was quite bad. It was just really vague and open to interpretation. I think they were just eager to just discuss it, but actually if we're going to have something like this on the table, we need to make sure every caveat, we've looked at every caveat and every, you know,
and there's really clear guidelines and really clear boundaries.
Yeah, and that there just wasn't from when I looked at it, so I kind of definitely agree with it being shut down. But I think it's something that people need to talk about more, and apparently like the public is more open to it now. Public opinion has changed,
with, like,
and that, yeah.
Our aging population, and Alzheimer's is a terrifying disease. You lose your personality, you lose your ability to look after yourself, all your memories. I mean, like, there's that argument, like, do you know who you are if you've lost all your memories?
Exactly.
Like, what makes you you? Like, and so many people are terrified of that happening to them. And if they start to go that way, should they not be allowed to choose to, you know, end on a high, as it were?
I think it's tricky, but I think it's something our generation need to start talking about, and I think this is what we're seeing, is it's becoming more of a public issue, and we need to not be afraid to address these big problems, because the more taboo there is around them, the more difficult it becomes to discuss it openly. And I think this is a good step to actually have an open debate about it, and sort of air views in a safe environment, rather than sort of be too scared to actually hear what people want to say about it.
Definitely. What was quite interesting, one MP said that, you know, within the 21st century, I don't think the argument too much pain is really like a fair argument to make anymore. Like, I don't know whether that exists with the medicine that we have now, and if someone is still experiencing too much pain, we should put a lot more research into why they're experiencing pain into that disease.
So
should be the focus there, he was saying. So
I guess the pain is so subjective that that's one of the things that is so difficult to address, because it's such a personal feeling, that what one person finds painful could be a completely different experience for someone else. So to use it in an argument on a parliamentary bill is really quite tricky.
Yeah,
some of my medical friends said that older women who've had kids have a completely different pain threshold to all the other patients, because they've obviously experienced really extreme pain that no one else has.
One of my favourite facts when we were learning about pain was that if you watch children in a playground, so I don't know if everybody knows this already, but if you watch how the mother responds, it massively dictates how the child responds. So if you fall down when you're 5 years old and bruise your knee, and your mum sort of says, just get up and carry on, the child will act like they haven't injured their knee. But if the mum panics and goes to hug the child and sort of holds the child, and then the child cries and feels pain. So it's really interesting kind of idea of what makes us feel something. Is it emotional reactions, or is it actual physical sensation?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, we had someone on the show recently who said crying is a sort of social form of wanting attention and wanting help, and you cry because you want people to kind of help you. Yeah, fascinating. Oh, we could talk about this all day, but we need to move on. So our next song, Hannah, you have chosen Man, I Feel Like a Woman. Why have you chosen this one?
Yeah, so since we're going to be talking about the roles of estrogen and testosterone, I thought we better have some feminization and some masculization. So we're starting with Shania Twain's Man, I Feel Like a Woman before we talk about estrogen further.
Welcome back. You are listening to Soho Radio Science Mixtape, and we are talking to Hannah Wilson about her research into cancer and sex hormones. Now, Hannah, I never even knew before you told me about this that there was any sort of link between cancer and sex hormones. How does that work? Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting area, because some of the cancers that we know about are actually driven by the sex hormones. So the area that we're involved in our team in Charing Cross is looking at prostate cancer, which is driven by the male hormone testosterone. So the research is looking at how we might suppress testosterone to improve prostate cancer, which is a well-known treatment, and our area is looking at sort of areas around that basic theme.
So by suppressing testosterone, you actually help to kind of delay the prostate cancer?
Yeah, so prostate cancer, the tumour itself, is driven by testosterone, which is the natural hormone in men. So unfortunately, if prostate cancer develops, we need to suppress the natural hormone to try and reduce the prostate cancer burden in men to treat the condition.
Gosh, that's fascinating. Are there any other cancers that are sort of driven by sex hormones?
Yeah, so breast cancer, sort of similar in terms of estrogen and the interaction with the tumour, and it's quite a complex area. I'm sure there are many more, but I'd have to sort of go back and check out before I said exactly where else it would fit in.
But I knew that we definitely, when you suppress testosterone, you do cause a lot of changes in a man, don't you? Because The Imitation Game came out recently, and we all know the famous story of Alan Turing in The Imitation Game,
yeah,
played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who was gay, and they chemically castrated him by taking away his testosterone.
So it's really interesting the way this is sort of presented again in the media, and I always find the link fascinating, and I'm learning myself how many times this treatment has been used. But when Alan Turing was treated, they were using the same sort of technique, I guess, to suppress testosterone in him to reduce his sexual feelings towards men. And I believe that in the past, similar techniques were used in terms of suppressing feelings that people might have for other sort of criminal acts, like paedophiles were treated in the same way. So it's an interesting area because it's a technique that's been used, and you mentioned chemical castration, which is what it's known as in the medical world, and this is obviously quite an unpleasant problem for men with prostate cancer, which is the team in Charing Cross is looking at how these effects could be better protected and improved.
So what happens to a man when you reduce his testosterone?
So a bit like what happens to women when they sort of reduce, or the levels of estrogen fall in what we know as the menopause, a similar thing can happen in men, but it's not a term that's accepted in the literature, and it's not something that we know too much about, mainly because there's not been that much research into it. But effectively, if you suppress testosterone in a man, they can experience these quite unpleasant symptoms. And these would include things like hot flushes, irritability, a loss of libido.
Oh my God, so they're having like a male menopause?
Effectively, yeah, they are.
Really?
Yeah, it's really weird, isn't it?
I didn't know guys could get a menopause.
Well, I don't really think it's an accepted sort of concept at the moment, but this is the problem. There's so much out there for what happens in women, but unfortunately there's just not the same evidence out there for what happens in men.
I don't even think there is that much research into what happens in women, because one of the shows I worked on recently, we were looking at kind of menopausal symptoms and how you can treat them. And there just seems to be such a variation of symptoms, and no one's quite sure about all the interactions. Like, there is research into the interactions, like does a stressful life make your symptoms worse, or do the symptoms make you more stressed? Is it like a cyclical thing like that? Is it to do with your weight? If you're overweight, do you have worse symptoms? Is it to do with your sleep? Like, all of these different things that are impacting, you know, how can we help people to deal with their hot flushes? How can we help to reduce them?
Yeah.
And no one's quite sure at the moment. And we were joking in my team. We were saying, well, is this because menopause only happens to women and most of the research is done by men, so just hasn't really been looked into properly yet?
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure about that, but I think the big difference with men is that, unlike with women, where there's an actual event where the estrogen is sort of effectively suddenly stopped being produced, so you have this menopause event, in men it's a gradual process over the years. So most men don't notice this effect because their testosterone level starts to decline slowly. So from about the age of 30, I think, but I better check, the testosterone starts to decline. But with prostate cancer, this happens suddenly because we're suppressing the testosterone quickly to treat the cancer. And this is why the effect might be more prominent. So it's about the time that it happens, or the speed at which the change occurs.
Okay, and so you're looking into ways that you can sort of help to limit the effects of...
Yeah,
so testosterone suppression.
Yeah, so the way that prostate cancer is treated at the moment around the globe is by a drug that suppresses testosterone. And I've been very lucky to work with a team who are looking at ways to develop, well, two main themes. One is to develop new drugs that might improve the side effects of such treatments. And the other is looking at, while we're currently using the treatment that suppresses testosterone, how can we improve the side effects that occur with men? And the main idea is to... that I'm not directly involved with, but is the trial that's going on, is to use estrogen to suppress testosterone as opposed to a drug that directly suppresses testosterone itself, which is really, really cool and could be really, really exciting for the future of how we treat this cancer.
And why would that be better than the current one?
So because of the effects of low testosterone in the body, if we can suppress testosterone but not suppress estrogen at the same time, then we might be able to mitigate some of the side effects that we see in men. Because by suppressing testosterone, we also suppress estrogen.
So you're suppressing both at the same time, just because...
So if we used estrogen to suppress testosterone, we might maintain the estrogen level and therefore improve some of the side effects that occur. So it's really, really exciting.
That is really cool. Right, well, we're going to take a little break and have our next song, which is What a Man by Salt and Pepper. And, I mean, I'm sure it's pretty obvious why I've chosen this one, but do you want to tell us anyway?
Of course. So we've had Man, I Feel Like a Woman, and we've been talking about estrogen. So now we're going to balance the sexes and talk a little bit about men, or listen a little bit about men, with this lovely song, All About Men. So for all the men out there.
And stay tuned, because just after that song, we're going to have Kyle Major's regular feature of 3 Minute Science. And this week he's talking to Andre Brown, who is a research fellow at the Behavioural Genomics Lab at the Institute of Clinical Science, all about his work in nematode words. So stay tuned for that. And then afterwards, we return to Hannah to hear more about exactly what her research project involves.
In my world, and although most men are hoes, he floats on the down low, cause I never heard about him with another girl. But
3 Minute Science.
3 Minute Science.
Yeah, it should be 4 minutes. In fact, this strain that we use is N2 strain of isolated.
I'm Andre Brown. I'm a group leader at the MRC Clinical Sciences Center at Imperial College, and I do behavioral genetics.
Can you explain your research to a colleague?
I would say we use automated imaging and quantitative phenotyping to identify sometimes subtle behavioral differences between different animals, and use that to try and do genetics, to try and find new functions for genes. So yeah, so we study the nematode worm C. elegans. It's a small worm that lives in compost heaps and rotting material, and we use it to study in detail how its behavior changes when you change genes.
Okay, and now can you explain your research to my grandmother?
I would say we look very carefully at worms to understand what's different between related worms and how that is even more different for distantly related worms.
And why worms?
Worms, because they have a relatively simple nervous system. They have only 302 neurons. It's a number you can count, something we think we can get a handle on. They're transparent, which means they're excellent for imaging. You can see through them, you can see what's inside, and they have a short life cycle. So that means that they're very convenient to use in the lab.
So why is this important?
It's important for several reasons. One is the sort of basic research aspect, which is really what we're primarily focused on, which is understanding how genes affect behavior. That's become sort of increasingly important in a way because we're now able to sequence genomes. We can find out all of the genes in an organism relatively quickly, but the huge challenge now is figuring out what they do. And that's still going to take a long time, and that's why we work on these relatively simple animals to try and make that faster.
In a decade, what will this research have taught us?
It will have taught us something about certainly how worms structure their behavior, how individual worms differ from each other, how complex their behavior is, and I hope it'll also be starting to give us insight into how other animals structure their behavior, more complicated animals, maybe fish. Maybe it'll even give us some insights into how humans behave.
If you had a computer big enough, do you think you could model a human brain?
Definitely not yet. I think we are still very ignorant of not just the connections, but also the principles underlying computation in the brain. So I think that's actually one of the great lessons from studying C. elegans. So we've known the wiring diagram for the C. elegans nervous system for more than 20 years. It's only 302 neurons, and we still actually aren't able to just put the C. elegans brain into a computer and simulate it. So if we can't do 300 neurons, 100 billion is not within reach anytime soon.
3 Minute Science.
3 Minute Science.
And thank you to Carl and Andre for that. Absolutely fascinating. Can't believe they've even tried to map a 300 neuron brain. That's wow.
Super cool.
Yeah. And we have tweeted, lovely producer Amna has tweeted a video of an Emmetone word. So head to our Twitter at Soho Radio if you want to take a look at what they look like. But now back to Hannah and her fascinating research herself. So Hannah, how did you get involved with sort of sex hormones and the side effects?
So it's an interesting sort of backstory to that, but basically I was really lucky with who I met at Imperial or Charing Cross where I was working. And one day I was introduced to this concept of pheromones and sniffing. And basically I was in a clinic with a professor who was kindly offering if I wanted any work, then perhaps I could do some sniffing of t-shirts. And I thought this was a bit of a strange discussion. So I sort of went away, did a little bit of reading and found out that he was actually talking about this really fascinating area of science, which was the effect of sex hormones in prostate cancer. And you're looking at me quite confused, I must say, of what I mean by sniffing.
I'm just wondering, did he just come up to you and be like, hey, do you want to come and sniff some t-shirts?
Not at all. It was we were talking about research and he was mentioning that there was this group of people who sort of in Stirling in Scotland sniffed t-shirts for a living, and I actually did that, and that was my reaction as somebody sort of, these people are sort of our age in their 20s, graduate students, and I was thinking, well, actually maybe there's an in here for something in London. And we got talking and it turns out
your own t-shirt, yeah, sniffing corporation.
Exactly. And interestingly, a few weeks later I saw that it's actually something that's used on the dating scene in London, that you take this t-shirt along and you sniff a t-shirt that you like the smell of, and then you get matched on the sniffing. Now I found this absolutely fascinating and really quite
that
strange.
That sounds hilarious.
I haven't been yet, but I think at some point then there's an in there for someone on the show to go. But it's this idea of making science cool for young people, and this really caught my attention. And obviously there's a serious theme behind it. The idea is that one of the side effects that we were talking about with prostate cancer, of suppressing testosterone to treat the tumor, is that you might change the pheromone complement.
So I'm just going to stop you there. What is a pheromone?
Yeah, so great question. A pheromone is basically something that is transmitted between individuals and is involved in many processes, but one of them is that it might be one of the reasons that we're attracted to who we're attracted to. So if we change our pheromone complement, does that affect the relationships we have? And one of the things that can happen in prostate cancer is you get these problems in relationships between partners who've been together for years. And it's this super interesting concept that maybe by suppressing testosterone, we're actually physically changing the pheromone makeup of a man. And that's why some of these spousal or partner relationship effects occurs. And I was absolutely hooked at this point. And especially when I then saw that sort of similar science was being used in the singles dating world in London, yeah, within a young person age group, I was really sort of fed back to the prof that this was really exciting. And there was definitely an interest there that led to how I really got involved in this area.
So literally by suppressing testosterone, they think they might be affecting another chemical messenger, which is this pheromone that you release a chemical into the air. And they think that that has something to do with the way we're attracted to people.
Potentially, yes. And it's something I've never thought about, why you're attracted to the people you're attracted to, but it could all underlie smell.
Yeah. There is a sense that you can't really choose who you're attracted to. Exactly. It just kind of happens, doesn't it?
Who knows?
Yeah, another secret message flying through the air.
Exactly, all on the secret messages today.
Yeah, and don't worry, the milk on the paper is drying. I haven't seen it at all. Producer Amna has it stashed safely away, and we will be coming back to see if I can read Hannah's message at the end of the show. So that's one possible side effect of suppressing testosterone, along with the kind of male menopause, or the nickname Hannah's told me is andropause, although that's not technically a clinical term, but yeah, this andropause, and they get the hot flashes and things. But what's the side effect that you look at?
Yeah, so it's, as I said, it's a massive team and there's so many people involved, but the area that I've ended up working in is the side effect of osteoporosis. And osteoporosis is a disease that affects bones and basically leads to a reduced bone mineral density.
So they break more easily,
yeah,
don't
so
they?
The bones break more easily. And a lot of people have heard of osteoporosis in relation to the menopause in women. Women are more susceptible after the menopause. But the same sort of idea in men, that if we are suppressing testosterone and therefore estrogen, are men more likely to have osteoporosis? And the answer has been proven a long time ago that yes, they are on these prostate cancer drugs. So what I'm looking at is how we might make this side effect less prominent, and how we might improve things for men. And that can be done by the way we image it and the way we predict it, so we know who's at more risk. So day to day, we're looking at the different way we can look at bone and how that might translate to these men. So there's such a huge area going on. This is just one tiny part of it. But the overall theme is saying, these are the treatments we're using. How can we make them better to improve quality of life, really, in patients?
Yeah, because you were saying before, it's not even about just curing cancer anymore, is it? Like, these treatments, well, they don't cure it, but they limit it from growing any further. And then it's, how do you sustain a good quality of life whilst you, I suppose you must be permanently on these medications once you start them.
Yeah, and I think this is something that is such an important concept in medicine for the future, is that we are getting so much better at treating disease, and curing a cancer is an amazing thing to do, but what about how it leaves the patient? And our team is really interested in these quality of life issues, and we need to make sure life is bearable if you are going to survive, and long term, what are the consequences going to be? And sadly, it's also financial. If by treating a prostate cancer, you actually induce an osteoporosis, which is itself...
Oh, God, yeah, I've never thought about that. Because then that's another, you know, quite expensive disease to treat, and then you're ill in another way.
Exactly, and it all adds up in the NHS. So it's about being sensible, and this is why...
Prevention rather than cure.
Exactly, and this is why the oestrogen is such an amazing idea, because we already use oestrogen in the treatment, so to speak, of menopause in women. So we're actually taking a drug that's already out there and now using it for a new disease. So that's a big shout out to the trial that's going on, that, as I said, I'm not directly involved in, but it's a really, really great idea in the NHS that we've currently face.
Yeah, that is super exciting. Oh, to be on the forefront of something like that, that's really cool, Hannah.
Yeah, feel very lucky.
Well, in the spirit of how you first got involved in that, I believe the next song you've chosen is Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. Do you have anything else to say about this song?
No, just that I thought everyone would get on the pheromone chat if we had a bit of a song related to it.
And coming up after this song, we'll be looking at the future of the NHS, which is much more linked to this kind of quality of life issue and something that you are particularly interested in.
Yeah. Arrive at my local polyclinic. Like half of my patients these days, patient B has degenerative brain disease. She no longer knows who she or her family is. I am passed a copy of her living will and begin a difficult conversation with her family. There is a heated exchange about the grandchildren, a speedy inheritance, and a mockery of the Hippocratic Oath. The family is referred to the Department of Euthanasia. I take 5 minutes out, reflecting on that landmark legislation.
And that was Hannah Wilson reading an extract from her article in the BMJ, A Glimpse into the Future, A Typical Day in the NHS in the Year 2050. Now, Hannah, as well as doing all your clinical research, you're actually also studying graduate medicine. You're coming to the end of that course in your final 6 months. And you've been writing these kind of articles in the BMJ. So tell me, how did you come to this vision of what the NHS is going to be like in the future?
Yeah, so I thought about this myself, and a few people have asked whether it developed whilst I was at medical school or whilst these ideas were there before. And interestingly, I wrote this before I actually started medical school. So I wrote this in my gap year in between studying after having done some medicine over in Tanzania. And I'm surprised at myself that these ideas were present, because a lot of it I probably would have still written now 3.5 years into the clinical training. But there's obviously been some sort of experience or imagination there of how things will be, just from conversations, I think, throughout previous university experience and at home, and talking to people and reading around the area, that have given me this, I guess, quite dystopian view of the future.
And obviously we can't read the whole article out, because that would take up quite a lot of time, but could you just give us, so you talked about this polyclinic, you talked about the Department of Euthanasia, what other ideas do you have for this future of the NHS that you've mentioned?
Yeah, so a lot of it is based on some of the ethics that we've talked about earlier, with the idea of euthanasia and how we're going to deal with slippery slopes in terms of the ethical problems we face. A lot of it is in terms of the fact that we're in a massive digital age of health, and we're in an age where people are so in tune with healthcare based on being able to Google anything and everything, and our generation turn up at the doctors almost with a diagnosis, and we sort of joke about that clinically as Dr. Google or Professor Google. And a lot of it is to do with obesity. It's to do with environmentally how we're destroying the environment. And also there's a few jokes in there about doctors themselves and this 7-day working week and will we ever retire? And there's a few things I think that I'd been exposed to as a child with medical parents talking about retirement. And my brother and I used to joke about that a lot with our mum and dad. And I think just being aware of the changes we face is an important thing. And as we discussed earlier, talking about these things and being open about the problems that we face and the ways things might change is a really good thing to be involved in at my stage of training.
Absolutely. There's been some really interesting news stories about the NHS lately. Mm. I mean, the NHS is always in the news, but you know, a study came out that was saying people are so stressed out in the NHS right now that they think about 80% of senior doctors might retire early. I mean, you're essentially in the front line with that. What do you think of that? Do you think that there is a lot of stress in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think, obviously, I'm so junior in the NHS that I'm not exposed to any of the pressures that I know these senior people are experiencing. But I definitely think that it's sort of a crunch point in the NHS now, and we're the generation to change it. So totally understandably, those who are coming towards the end of the careers, who've lived through this age of the beginning of the NHS and how amazing it was, you can understand why now it might just seem sort of too much. Whereas I think we have to approach it that now's the time to make the changes and now's the time to invest to make it better for our future.
Although with the slide towards, I mean, they want to introduce the 7-day working week for doctors and a slide toward kind of 24-hour care, in that sense, a lot of doctors, it's not that attractive to be staying. Yeah. And they're talking about kind of the doctor drain fleeing, all our lovely NHS trained doctors fleeing abroad.
I know, it's a really scary issue actually. And it's something that we're thinking about all the time as new doctors and certainly our friends, our mutual friends who are already on the process of starting their training. There's this whole concept of F3 and going to New Zealand, Australia and Vancouver. And it's a big problem because we need to make the NHS attractive for doctors here to stay. Not just, obviously, the NHS has to be there for the patients and the public, but we want the best doctors and we want people to want to stay here. And the 7-day working week is obviously a huge hot topic of debate at the moment. And it's tricky because I'm not speaking from any experience of what I would know it would be like to work weekends, but we all want the best care when we're ill, but also people want to have a standard of living that allows them to be with their families. And it's a really difficult thing to get right.
Especially in such a massive organisation where, you know, any kind of change you want to make is going to be very slow and have to go through many, many levels.
Yeah.
But do you think that we will be having... So another part of your article that I really liked was how you assess a patient via a video link with Singapore, and you have, you know, you're at a global hospital and there's, you know, different required robots. Do you think in 50 years we will be seeing this kind of technology and this kind of global communication on such a regular basis?
Yeah, I really do. And I have to say, this is something that as the training has gone on, you see more and more of. I mean, at the moment, and I'd have to double check, I'm not quite sure that this is actually occurring, but we have these big meetings now where we're linking up with Sydney or we're linking up with New Zealand discussing cases. And it's the idea, we're already using robots in surgery. The Da Vinci robot is a way that we treat prostate cancer surgically. So I probably should have said at the beginning, treating prostate cancer with hormones is just one of the ways in which we can treat that disease. But there's a lot of technology out there already. And when you think about how robots use, you don't need the controls to be next to you. So why could it not be that the surgeons internationally are treating people from their own homes?
Oh my God, that's a crazy concept.
Crazy, but I think potentially possible.
They did say that surgery is like quite similar to playing video games, and children that have spent a lot of time playing video games make better surgeons. That's sort of one theory. I mean, it's not completely proven, but it's like a trend. And that literally would be your like, in this room of the global hospital and all the surgeons logging into their screens to do some remote operation.
It's a really cool idea, but it's whether it would ever happen, I'm not sure. And certainly I imagine over in the East is where this kind of technology is probably being developed most quickly. And I think children over there are so much more exposed to digital, I can't think of the word now, but technology from such an early age that I genuinely think that maybe one day this is how it could be.
Absolutely fascinating. I love trying to imagine the future. Who knows? No one thought social media was going to exist until it did.
Exactly.
Right, well, we are coming up towards the end of our show. We've got time for one more song while I get the iron ready. If you're listening at home, it's time to get that iron out, get it on, and get ready to iron over your milk and see if you can read your secret message. So we're going to get our eye on. What song are we having next, Hannah?
So our last song is a song that we grew up with, which is Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall.
Teach to leave them kids alone.
About dystopian futures there. Fantastic choice, Hannah. Now it is time for us to see if I can read our secret message. So
good luck, Tom.
Here's the paper, nice and dry. I have no idea what it says, and I'm gonna have to move away from the microphone to do this. So I think if you describe to our listeners what I'm doing.
Okay, so she's got the piece of paper and she's taking an iron, which I can't actually believe she's managed to bring into the studio, but she has. She hasn't ironed her top though, so never a word of her about that. And here she
crease
is
free just, material.
Here she is ironing the paper at the moment as we speak. And I'm dubious, but something does appear to be happening. So I hope she can translate this wonderful message that I've written. It sort of sums up our friendship actually quite well, Matilda.
I've located another microphone. So what this is meant to be doing, we painted the paper, our secret message, with milk. And the iron is meant to be burning so the water from the milk has evaporated, and as you move the iron over what's left behind, you should see that the milk goes slightly brown.
It does appear to be getting a bit brown.
And the fat in the milk gets slightly burnt by the iron. I'm worried that I'm really poor at ironing because there seems to be a lot of water.
It's like I'm quite concerned about your ironing technique here, I have to everywhere. Say.
Well, it hasn't gone as brown as it could have done, but I can definitely make out that it says show poker face.
So obviously that's the song that sums up Matilda and I's university experience together, a bit of Lady Gaga, so I thought it'd only be appropriate that we played out on that tune, and that's how she revealed what my final song was going to be.
Brilliant, secret message worked. There you go, milk and an iron, all you need to be a spy in the future. Thank you so much for listening, Hannah. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
See you all next week. Bye.
I'll get him high, show him what I got. Oh, 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 oh. I'll get him high, show him what I got. Poker face.